Tell me again, how many songs are written about you, but how many of them are good? That's For Everest. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. A Blue Jays off day on Monday means more ink and bandwidth and airtime committed to what was a very bad weekend for the Toronto Blue Jays. And Alek Manoah is once again the story of Toronto baseball. A lot written, a lot said about Alek Manoah over the last couple of days. Little of it good. There may be some small windows for encouragement. Certainly, if you talk to John Schneider, it sounds that way. He will get another start on the weekend. A bit of Jays news to go through today. We're also going to talk to Andy McCullough a little later in the show. He has a Clayton Kershaw book that's out today. He's also been a little down on the Jays over the years and was part of a survey of MLB executives over at The Athletic that was looking at the best front offices in baseball. The Toronto Blue Jays did not receive a vote from across 40 execs. We'll talk to Andy about all this. Right now, though, we're going to talk to someone who was down there for Alek Manoah's first start back in the majors, who wrote a great piece setting it up, all the things Alek Manoah had tried to change and adjust and fix since we last saw him in August, and then wrote coming out of it that wasn't enough, as encouraging as those first three innings may have been. It's Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet, of Sportsnet.ca. Arden, good morning. Thanks for doing this. How are we doing?
Good, man. How are you, Blake?
I am. I'm pretty good. Before we get to the Alek Manoah stuff, little bit of news yesterday. Jamie Campbell first reporting that the Blue Jays are going to sign Aaron Sanchez to a minor league deal. Old friend of the Toronto Blue Jays, of course. Somehow, just age 31. Somehow, time seems to move very, very quickly and very, very slowly at the same time. Arden, you this is not official yet, but you quote retweeted that news that Aaron Sanchez is expected to report to Buffalo today and will be in the rotation there. What can you tell us about the Jays adding Sanchez to that Buffalo Bisons mix?
Yeah, that's what I was told, that he'd be reporting to Buffalo today. So I assume that's still the case. And you're right, he's going to go there to work as a starter. And I think this probably has more to do with the Buffalo Bisons just needing anyone who can throw a baseball right now, more so than the Blue Jays being confident that Aaron Sanchez is going to be someone who's going to impact them in a major way at the big league level. You know, Sanchez hasn't been in the big league since 2022, and his numbers at AAA last year were not great. He was in Minnesota's organization. He was with the D-backs a bit, and it was like a 5.5 ERA over a pretty significant AAA sample last year. So I think this just has more to do with the fact that the Bisons have just been devastated by both injuries and players being lost from the organization and other players being promoted, to the point where they're just regularly running bullpen days week after week. And, you know, these poor guys, Hayden Yeager and Troy Watson and Luis Quiñones, you know, Paxton Schultz, these dudes are just throwing like 30, 40 pitch relief appearances. And it's just really not sustainable what Buffalo's been doing from a pitching standpoint. So we've seen them make a few moves over the last week just to add some warm bodies there and people who can get on a mound and throw a competitive pitch. So, you know, that's the idea with Aaron Sanchez going forward. Obviously, we all hope that he goes out and he's vintage Aaron Sanchez and he's incredible and he has this amazing renaissance and he comes up to Toronto and we all get to tell this amazing story. I really do think this is just more about the Bisons being pitchers right now than anything.
Yeah, the biggest stat with Aaron Sanchez's AAA numbers last year is probably just that he threw 90 innings, and they need a guy who can go out there and give them four or five. You mentioned there were a couple other moves. The Jays signed Bo Sulcer to a minor league deal the other day as well. He immediately started and pitched 3 1/3 for Buffalo. Again, not a guy who's probably on the major league radar unless, you know, there are always situations. They signed Wes Parsons the middle of last year for AAA depth, and he ended up getting a cup of coffee up at the majors. They also traded for Joel Kunol from the Astros for cash considerations. That's a relief arm, not a starting arm. But yeah, they just need bodies there, kind of any port in a storm right now, to the extent that I not jokingly was like, well, Mitch White got DFA'd. Maybe he's available as well. So the AAA scene, this is a trickle down from the majors. The reason Alek Manoah is a big topic of conversation is in part because Bowden Francis is on the IL and Yariel Rodriguez is on the IL. At least one of those guys was probably expected to be at AAA right now. And maybe if one or both of them are healthy, Alek Manoah's work is continuing to do his work at AAA. That's not the case. This all trickles down. We did see Alek Manoah on Sunday make his first start in the majors in about 9 months. And you wrote this great piece going into some of what he'd been working to change since we last saw him in August. The body is obvious. He looks like a different player than last year. There's a little bit more athleticism on the mound there. The delivery has changed a little bit and was working to get it a little bit more consistent. The results weren't there on Sunday. In looking at that start from a more granular perspective, Arden, did you see some of those things that you wrote about that Manoah and the Jays were hoping to see in his first start back, results aside?
There were things to build upon, and like what the Blue Jays have been encouraged about with Manoah this year, really since spring training, is that the stuff is ticked back up. And it's by no means at the place that it was in 2021 and 2022 when Manoah was really, really good, but it's certainly better than it was last season when Manoah was really uncompetitive at the big league level. So that's encouraging. The velo is back. Some of the movement on the slider is back. Like, there's things to build on there. And some of that has to do with the hard work he put in over the offseason on his body, obviously. Some of that has had to do with some delivery stuff and some refinements in his mechanics that he's made so that he can more consistently find his release point and just be more synced up in his delivery and have a better tempo down the mound. It's still a work in progress. And I think you're right to say that if Yariel Rodriguez is healthy right now, or if Ricky Tiedemann is healthy and effective right now, Alec Manoah is probably a AAA, and the Blue Jays have a better option for the fifth spot in their rotation, but they don't. So Alec Manoah is going to keep pitching at the big league level and trying to make strides and trying to put things together and get better at a time when he's going to be going out in games that the Blue Jays really need to win. So sometimes it might look like it did the other day, where he comes out and in the first two innings, I mean, you're kind of seeing not vintage Alec Manoah, but certainly playable at the big league level Alec Manoah. He struck out five of the six for his first six batters, and he threw some really nasty sliders that Pitching Ninja was like immediately putting up because of the bite that was on them and the awkward swings he was getting on them. And he was throwing some nice two seamers to the edges, and the two seam had like really good late life on it. And that's what Manoah needs. But then obviously we saw the two innings that followed that, where he was missing over the heart of the plate and getting hammered, where he was walking guys, he was nibbling, he wasn't as confident with his stuff in the zone. It's still an ongoing process with him, and all these things sort of work in concert with each other, stuff, delivery, and command. And if you don't have one of those things, you know, the other two can be impacted. Like, you really need all three of them for Alec Manoah to be at his best. So that process continues. The reality of the Blue Jays pitching depth right now, so that process is just going to be taking place at the big league level.
Yeah, and there were some options, you know, an off day last week, two off days this week, an off day next week. You could have got through with a four-man rotation for a little bit. Really, you could have gone, the way the off days worked out, you could have gone almost 4 weeks only needing one bullpen day before you needed a fifth guy. The Jays have obviously opted not to do this. So we're going to see Alec Manoah again on the weekend. We're going to see him against the Minnesota Twins. That's a lefty-heavy lineup. That's a team that's fresh off a 12-game winning streak and throwing cured meats at each other to celebrate. The vibes are good over there. What do you, you just kind of said it. He needs all three of those things working together, the command, the delivery, and the stuff. What is, you know, to hear Manoah talk about it after the start and in your piece with the quotes from Manoah, it does seem like for him, it's that nibbling, it's that missing with uncompetitive pitches away from the zone that he thinks is the key to him going longer into a game. Would you agree with that? That, you know, hey, those four and five pitch walks where none of the four seamers are within a ball's width of the zone, is that kind of what'll be front of mind for you when he next takes the bump?
Yeah, he just has to be more aggressive, and he just can't fall behind as much as he was. You know, I had somebody tell me before his start that where his stuff is at right now, it plays when it's in the zone. When it's out of the zone and when hitters at the big league level are recognizing that Manoah isn't quite synced up and isn't quite being as aggressive and nibbling like he was over his last two innings, they're going to lay off of that stuff. And they're just going to sit on the fat slider that he mislocates over the heart of the plate. And when they get that, they're going to hit an awful long way. So for Manoah, I think he just has to be much more aggressive, and he just has to be getting strike one a lot more often and working ahead a lot more often, and he has to just kind of build some momentum and get into a rhythm like we saw him in the second inning the other day. So I think that really is the biggest thing for him, because the stuff is there. The mechanics, the delivery, the tempo is better. It's not as consistent as it needs to be, but it's better. So once he gets all three of these factors, stuff, delivery, and command working together, I think he can be a capable number five starter in the big leagues, but it obviously has to be better and it has to be more consistent than it was the other day.
And now that the Jays have gone down this road of, hey, he's going to start on the weekend, we're not going to use these extra off days to run a four-man rotation. He's going to get chances, and Bowden Francis is eligible to come off of the IL on the weekend, but we haven't heard of a rehab assignment or anything like that just yet. Yariel Rodriguez eligible May 15th. I'd assume both of those guys would at least need, you know, one quick trip down to AAA, and Bowden was working out of the bullpen most recently. So Manoah is going to have some time here. Now, I know some people might be hearing us try to find some positives here and wonder, you know, why at this point. And the answer is that the Jays don't have other options, and we got to build on the, you know, they have to build on this. And you never want to throw a guy out entirely. It does create, and this is a feeling that you struck really, really well in your post-game piece on Sunday, Arden. And you had this great lead where you're talking about Alek Manoah's slider early in the game. You're talking about Vlad jumping on that grand slam. And you make this point of, hey, if this article was being written in June of 2021, we'd all be like really, really fired up about this. But the article is not being written in June 2021. So first of all, great work on that kind of extended lead there. But how much does that kind of strike you as, like, this is the situation the Blue Jays are in right now, and whether it's Vlad, whether it's Bo, whether it's Manoah, you know, whether it's this sense of, well, what is the window and where is the urgency, this still feels a little stuck in where they were a couple years ago, not where they're supposed to be now in 2024.
Right, and the big difference in 2021 as well is you had so much more runway in terms of your pre-ARB and ARB years with your young core, when it was Vlad and Bo and guys that we don't talk about as much in that conversation, but who we should when it comes to Danny Jansen and Jordan Romano and you know, Jose Berríos at the time in 2021. I mean, it wasn't even a Blue Jay right at the beginning of that season. So, you know, Kevin Gausman and Chris Bassett, like all of these pieces together, like you could just pull up the roster resource page and just kind of look at the cliff approaching for this team and the clear pivot point approaching if they don't win and they don't start winning soon. Like, this is a really, really important year for the future of this club and of this core. Like, if the Blue Jays continue losing at the rate that they have been, if they perform the way they have over the first 35 games, over the next 35, they're going to quickly put themselves in a position where they have to make some very uncomfortable decisions and some really high stakes, high leverage decisions for just the future of this competitive window and what the next few years of Blue Jays baseball are going to look like. So, like, that's the biggest difference between now and 2021 is that, you know, you can have, you know, Vlad looking great over his last 5 to 6 games, and who knows, maybe Manoah goes out against the Twins next weekend and, you know, throws 6 innings of 2-run ball. Like, that would all be great, but I mean, there is a bigger picture concern here of what this team's going to look like over the rest of this year, what it's going to look like next season, and some of the decisions that they might have to make come July if things continue the way they've been going.
Yeah, it makes for a good sports talk radio in July, but not in the way we'd like. We'd like to be talking about what purchased pieces, what buy moves can change the direction of the team for this year and next, not potentially the other way. So Arden, another one of these pieces is Bo Bichette, and he has struggled. You know, we've probably talked more about Vlad on this show than Bo, but Bo is in the worst extended stretch of his career. You know, if we're talking statistically, if we're talking some of the, you know, quality of contact wise, you had another great piece on the weekend talking to Bo about this. And it was called, Is There Cause for Optimism Amidst Bo Bichette's Batting Struggles? It's up at sportsnet.ca. It's still relevant today if people haven't checked it out yet. So on the weekend, Bo gets moved down in the order. He goes 1-for-11 with a walk. We're now at 11 games and a couple of weeks here since he last had an extra base hit. I mentioned it. These are the worst production numbers of his career over, say, a 30-game stretch, over a 100-game stretch. You included the kind of rolling weighted on base average graph from FanGraphs in your piece, and that's as low as it's been since, you know, his rookie season at least. What are you seeing with Bo Bichette right now, kind of big picture? And I know you kind of end that piece with maybe reasons for optimism moving forward the next little bit. Let's save that just for now. What are you seeing within Bo Bichette's struggles to start this year?
Just to focus just on the struggles, really, it's he's not making the same quality of contact that he has in the past. I mean, the strikeout rate, the walk rate, the chase rate, the aggressiveness, all that stuff is like not only consistent with his body of work at the big league level, it's, in some cases it's better. Like he has been really like discerning at the plate, particularly lately, in a way that Bo Bichette often isn't. We're used to seeing him take some pretty wild swings on pitches outside the zone. We're used to him taking some pretty big shots early in counts and doing that thing where he comes up empty and spins around and his batting helmet flies off. We're not seeing that as much lately, and you can look at the swings and takes over the last week in particular, and it's like, whoa, like Bo Bichette's making great swing decisions in a way that he doesn't normally. The problem is like the barrel rate and the quality of contact just hasn't been there for him. So, you know, the theory around the team throughout the last few weeks has been that he's just a tick off, and that sort of supports it. And Bo's been doing a lot of things to try to get his barrel to the ball a bit more. And he told me not to talk about optimism right now, so I won't mention that, you know, the exit velos have been strong over the last few games. But yeah, that has been the issue.
No, we'll get to the optimism part. I just wanted to do the, you know, what's actually wrong part first. And yeah, we flashed, producer Amit Mann flashed a graphic there showing Bo's percentile ranks in a couple different stats, and it's near the bottom of the league in barrel rate, which is exactly what it sounds like, how often you barrel up a ball. You know, his expected stats are as weak or nearly as weak as his actual stats so far. You know, he's in the bottom 5 percentile, Arden, in the entire league in expected XW Obacon, which obviously people laugh at anytime they see it, but, you know, the quality of contact, when you do make contact, how would you expect the results to turn out? He's in the bottom 5th percentile there. So this isn't a Vlad thing where the quality of contact is good and the results aren't there. The quality of contact is also not there. Career high ground ball rate, career low pull rate. Maybe that's intentional because he's trying to use the whole field. Maybe that's, he's just a tick off in being able to get around on stuff. All of these things are in the wrong direction. So pause. And now over the last couple games, it has looked a little bit better. I mentioned he went 1-for-11 on the weekend with a walk. Those aren't great results. He got tossed out of a game because he got pinched on a third strike that probably most of the time would not be a third strike. That seemed to me like a self-frustration as much as a frustration with the umpire. We are starting to see some signs that Bo is close. What are you seeing in that regard right now? You mentioned the swing decisions being a part of it. He's not chasing nearly as much as we're used to. He's kind of got an idea of what to swing at. What are we looking for this next little bit to say, hey, Bo's not only close, but it's turning a corner here?
Yeah, there's part of me also that wonders whether actually the best approach for Bo is to take some wilder swings and to expand a little bit. Like, that's what he's done when he's been at his best in the big leagues. And it seems kind of counterintuitive, right? But I do think Bo is kind of at his best when he has a really good plan and has a really good idea of what he's going to be thrown, or at least like has taken a, you know, a pretty educated guess and like sells out for that early in a plate appearance. We've seen him ambush so many pitchers like that before. That is naturally going to lead to some pretty wild swings when the pitcher just goes left when he thinks that they're going right. But that also leads to him hitting some balls like 420 feet. So I kind of wonder if maybe he needs to get back to expanding and chasing a bit more. But when you look at just like the results over the last like 5 or so games, I mean, half of his balls in play or somewhere around there have been up over 100 miles per hour. You know, you mentioned that, you know, he's working some deeper plate appearances and fouling some more things off. Like he just, even just talking to him, he says that he feels good at the plate over the last 4 or 5 games for the first time all year. You know, in April, like he was doing some weird stuff at the plate. Like he was abandoning his 2-strike approach, leg kicking with 2 strikes, and move around the box. Like he was just doing anything to get that feeling at the plate. He worked with his dad in Toronto throughout the last homestand on a bunch of swing stuff, and it seems like he's finally gone to a place where he's feeling good. The results just haven't been there. He's been hitting some balls very hard at fielders. He's been hitting too many ground balls, certainly, but you know, there are signs that like he is very close to coming out of that. And we've seen earlier in his career when he's slumped, I mean, with slumps, the most famous time obviously being in 2022, when he really didn't look like himself through like the first 5 months of the season. And then in September, he was like the hottest hitter on the planet. and it had like an 1100 OPS in September. But that's not the only time that happened. Like this happened to him in the minors as well. Like, when he was at Double A, that championship winning team in 2018 with John Schneider at the helm and Biggio and Vlad were on that team. I think Danny Jansen was there. Jordan Romano was there. Bo slumped significantly that year. And then when he came out of it, like he just went nuts over his next month and a bit. So we've seen this from him before where he gets into a pretty deep rut. And then when he comes out of it, he comes out of it in a very loud way. So that's not a guarantee it's going to happen again. But we've seen it happen twice before, and there are some indicators that he's getting close to coming out of it right now.
Yeah, of all the guys who can have a struggle, and again, part of this is we've seen it and we've seen him come out of it, but it's the level of hitting ability there is just so high that you have, or I have a confidence at least, that Bo Bichette will eventually figure that out and get hot. Within that Manoah piece that you wrote on Sunday, Arden, you also had some notes about Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who, you know, this is a similar conversation. His is more, hey, you're hitting the ball hard, you're not getting the results. The process-wise maybe hasn't turned in the right direction like Bo's has, although, you know, John Schneider would say his at-bats all year have been a pretty damn solid, was the quote you had from John Schneider in that Vlad piece. He hits a grand slam on a cookie on the weekend, but some bad plate appearances scattered around that. How are you feeling about where Vlad is right now? And I know you use some of those comps of similar hitters who peaked a little bit later or found kind of who they'd be as a hitter a little bit later. How much is that on your mind as we work through another Vlad slump here?
Well, yeah, you got at it. The maddening thing about Guerrero is just the inconsistency, because you see the grand slam on the weekend, and that is just like vintage Vlad. And you see like a pretty good walk in that game as well. But that's only two of his plate appearances. And the other two plate appearances of the game, I mean, he hits a ball really hard just straight into the ground. And he also chases a two-strike pitch that the Vlad of years ago would not chase. And he makes an out on a pitch that he really ought not to be swinging at. And that's been the inconsistency of his season, really. I mean, we've seen plate appearances where he looks exceptionally dialed in and he's taking close pitches, and you hear him on the broadcast going, no, and he takes them, and he's right. You know, he has, when he's showing that ball to strike judgment that we saw from him coming up through the minors, you see those plate appearances, but then sometimes, even within the same game, you see him whiffing at ball-to-ball sliders down and away. And you see the opposing catchers setting up in the opposite batter's box and still getting swings from him. It's the maddening thing. And it's harder to make the case that Vlad is close to coming out of it because of how hard he hits the ball, because he always hits the ball hard. And this is 2 years now where the expected stats have not lined up with the actual stats. So it's harder to make a luck-based argument when we're talking about like 800 plate appearances. Yeah. Now, where he's had the biggest gap in baseball, or among the biggest gaps in baseball, between his expected slugging and his actual slugging. I mean, there clearly is something going on here where he is not getting the results that he ought to for the quality of contact that he makes, that is more than just hitting it right at guys. There's something in the swing, something in the mechanics, something in the spin of the ball off of his bat. I mean, I don't have those answers. The Blue Jays clearly don't have those answers. I've asked John Schneider about it. He said, I don't have the magic answer. Like, that's a direct quote from Schneider. So it's something that is an ongoing process for the Blue Jays, and for Vlad is just trying to help him put things back together and look like the guy who he was in 2021 again. He has been better over the last week. Like, I think he's been far from this team's biggest issue over the last week. That is encouraging, but there's obviously still a ways to go for Vlad to really get the most out of his potential. And yeah, like you mentioned, he's still only 25, and it wouldn't be the first time that we've seen a hitter of this profile not put it all together until he's 26, 27, 28. You know, you can look at Edwin Encarnacion and Carlos Delgado in this market, who are guys that took a while to put it all together. David Ortiz became a Hall of Famer, not really being good until he was like 27. Adrian Gonzalez is a guy who didn't really put it together until later in his 20s. Todd Helton. There's a lot of players of that kind of first baseman DH slugger profile who didn't really get the most out of their abilities and their potential until their late 20s. So I know people are sick of hearing about Vlad's age and about how he's still young, but he is still only 25, and he's still got a lot of runway to go before he's even into the midst of his prime as a big leaguer.
It's a hard sport, Arden. It's a difficult sport, and that's helpful to keep in mind with some of those examples you just laid out. Don't know that it gets better for Vlad in terms of the hard contact stuff tonight. They're facing Christopher Sanchez, a lefty for the Phillies, who has the second best ground ball rate in all of baseball. He does allow loud contact, but it's all into the ground. So don't know that tonight's the night we get a solution on these things, but should be a fun one. Thanks for taking the time out this morning. Have a good time down in Philly.
Thanks, man. Take it easy.
Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet, of Sportsnet.ca. He's our digital coverage for this series this week. So two games down in Philly, he'll have you covered at Sportsnet.ca. It's a 6:40 start tonight, so make sure you're dialed in a little early. It's Dan, Joe, and Hazel on the call. Jamie and Shy are Blue Jay Central. I'll stop by tonight and give you a little more on Christopher Sanchez on Blue Jay Central as well. Ben Schulman and Chris LaRue on the radio. We're going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we're going to go outside the Blue Jays market a little bit. We're going to talk about Clayton Kershaw, who, you know, we talk a lot on this show about numbers and analytics and things like that. And one of the things that I kind of lose my analytics card for sometimes is the short stints for pitchers, the lower innings totals and stuff like that. I don't love it. I miss the workhorse days. I miss when a guy would throw, you know, Gustavo Chacin threw 200 plus innings when he first came up. We were looking at that the other day. Clayton Kershaw is one of the last of that last era of guys, I think. And Andy McCullough wrote an entire biography of Clayton Kershaw that gets into that. Talk to like 200 people for this book. Talk to Clayton Kershaw for it, the people around him, the people around baseball. I'm really excited to read that one. We're going to take a break. We're going to talk to Andy about his new book, The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw and the Burden of Greatness. We'll also talk some Jays stuff and the NL getting us off to an early start on trade season. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays back in action, 6:40 tonight. You can text us about it, 590-590. We might sprinkle a couple of those in by the end of the episode here as we tee up Jose Berríos against Christopher Sanchez, one of the league's emerging premier ground ball artists, trailing just about nobody in ground ball rate so far this year, trailing only Max Fried. So pretty good pitching matchup there down in Philly. 6:40 tonight, 105 game tomorrow. Nice quick little in and out in Philadelphia. Quick in and out, I'd imagine, because he's in L.A. for the release of his book, but he is not L.A.-based, is our next guest, Andy McCullough of The Athletic. He is also the author of The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw and the Burden of Greatness, a biography of Clayton Kershaw that is out now. Andy, thanks for joining us, and congrats, man. It's finally here.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a long process getting to today, but very excited for people to get a chance to read.
So what is, I want to ask you some questions about the book, about Clayton Kershaw, like we did when you, a little bit when you came on with us last year, and it was kind of still in the writing process, but
sure.
What is, so you're, I'm always fascinated by this because, you know, I've been in a beat writer position, and I know you're more of a national writer for The Athletic, but you're trying to do your job as you go, and you're working on this Clayton Kershaw book over the last couple of years. What is that process like? How long have you been cobbling together this Clayton Kershaw biography?
Yeah, I think I am a national writer at The Athletic, which is I made the unfortunate mistake of texting Ken Rosenthal last year that I said I thought the Blue Jays were paper tigers, and he's been using that in columns for literally 6 months. so hopefully the Blue Jays will someday prove both of us wrong. So I started the process, you know, a couple years ago, you know, approached Kershaw to see if he would agree to, you know, be a part of it. And, you know, he said that he would, you know, sit and talk for it. And so it was just a, you know, kind of a long process of like, you know, carving out time to talk with him during the off season in 2022. And then at a variety of times during the 2023 season. You know, I have a cat that wakes me up at 4 in the morning every day. And so rather than then go back to sleep. I would just kind of write from like 4 to about, you know, 6 or 7. And then I would start doing my actual job around like 8 or 9. So to all aspiring authors out there, get a cat.
Yeah, I have one. And yeah, especially now that the weather has turned where the sun is out early. Yeah, I did the rare gym before the show instead of after the show today because I was up at like 6. And what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
So you obviously talked to Clayton Kershaw a ton for this book. You also talked to like 200 people for this book. I'd imagine you talked to a lot of Clayton Kershaw's kind of contemporaries around baseball. What is the overarching opinion on Clayton Kershaw and what his place in this era of baseball is?
Yeah, I mean, overwhelming respect from his contemporaries. I mean, understandably, right, the public has, he receives a lot of criticism for the way he's pitched in the postseason. But I think what is really interesting is when you talk to the people who do what he does for a living, it's very challenging to find someone willing to say anything even remotely critical of him. I think because most of his peers are kind of just in awe of the consistency of the way he sort of conducted himself and also the, you know, sort of his willingness to risk his health, you know, financial stuff, you know, over the years. And one of the, you know, what was really interesting is especially in this generation of pitchers where there's, you know, discussion of like, you know, guys sort of hulking up to gain velocity and pitch labs and all this sort of like growth. He's kind of been doing the same thing for about 15 years, right? Like he kind of gets guys out the same way he did back in like 2010, 2011. And there's a real sort of appreciation from that from younger guys who are, you know, the question they like when I would have conversations with younger pitchers, like someone like Shane McClanahan, they would say things to the effect of like, I just want to ask him like, how, you know, how does he do it? And, you know, it's kind of like, well, try throwing, you know, fastballs and sliders glove side down and see how that goes. Cause that's kind of what he does. So yeah, I mean, just sort of overwhelming, you know, respect. I mean, Garrett Cole said he thinks he's the best left-handed pitcher of all time. Madison Bumgarner says he thinks he's the best pitcher of all time. You know, Paul Goldschmidt said he's, you know, his favorite player, which makes him angry because he hates pitchers. So, you know, it was really one of the enjoyable processes, getting to talk to other players about Kershaw.
It sounds very fascinating. It sounds like a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to reading the book. One of the things that stands out to me, you mentioned the consistency. Kershaw's been doing this since 2010, 2011. He's pitched over 2,700 innings, almost 3,000 if we include the postseason. He's got a 2.48 ERA for his career. Obviously, some postseason blips in there, but in the regular season, he's been the best pitcher since like he came on the scene in 2008, basically, and was right away a league average arm and built from there with three Cy Youngs. When we contextualize Kershaw now, and particularly say 10 years from now when we contextualize Kershaw, he might be, and I hope I'm wrong about this, I hope we go back in the other direction, but I can't imagine there are going to be too many guys after this that push for 3,000 innings in a career, whether we include postseason or not. How much does that, the workhorse aspect of this, how important is that to Kershaw, and how important is that to this kind of, you know, picture of Kershaw that you've painted in the book?
For sure. I mean, and that's kind of where the title comes from, right? Like the last of his kind. Like I know at some point last year, when he got to 200 wins, that I looked at kind of the active players who had a chance, and like Adam Wainwright was a couple away and, you know, eventually got there. And then you go down the list and it's like the next person who had a shot was Garrett Cole, who I think was at like 140. And then after that, it's like, Garrett Cole might be the last to get to 200 if he's able to, you know, get healthy and continue on the path that he's been on. And so, I think that the way that pitchers are trained now, what is expected of them is completely different than it was, you know, 15 years ago when Kershaw came into the league. And it's also very different than it was, you know, 5 to 7 years ago. And I think that, you know, you are seeing teams no longer asking pitchers to shoulder that sort of load, in part because they saw how someone who was as good and as strong and, you know, as sort of willing to take on the challenge as Kershaw was, they saw what it did to his body. I mean, he's been dealing with, you know, significant injuries dating back to, you know, almost a decade now, you know, going in, especially since 2016 with the back stuff. And so I think the industry has changed in part because they have seen how even the best of the best, like the best of the generation, struggle to handle it with the way that, you know, pitching is right now.
Yeah, and Kershaw right now, you know, for anyone who is like, hey, I haven't heard that name in a bit, what's going on? He is on the IL right now. He did sign a 1-year deal with a player option with the Dodgers. He's still around, threw a bullpen the other day, according to beat writers. So he is, you know, he's around, but it sounds like this will cost him, a good chunk of this year as well. The other component, Andy, and who knows, maybe this isn't an A to B correlation, like maybe the causation is not necessarily there with the correlation. But in addition to the body issues, one of the difficult parts of contextualizing Kershaw's greatness is he hasn't been as good in the playoffs. His ERA in the playoffs is 4.49 for his career. And I mentioned earlier, it's a sub 250 in the regular season. So not that 4.49 is a bad playoff ERA, but the Dodgers have gone to the playoffs a ton and they've only won one championship, and Clayton Kershaw has rarely been Clayton Kershaw come postseason time. How does he work through that? I know you talked to him about it, and I guess how do we as a larger part, you know, to me, because how to word this, to me, the fact that he is so durable and has pitched through so much and is never healthy come playoff time, but is pitching anyway, that is a part of it for me, even though, yes, it's a very clear criticism for people to levy that, hey, Clayton Kershaw wasn't as good in the playoffs. What do you make of that as someone who has followed this guy for his entire career?
Yeah. Forgive me if my math on this is going to be wrong, but if you go six innings and give up three runs, your ERA is 4.5, right? That's a quality start.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, average quality start. Now, if you ask him what's a quality start, he will tell you it is not going six innings and giving up three runs, right? I think what, you know, look, the book is not meant to absolve or defend or, you know, sort of like say, no, the stuff that happened in the postseason, none of it was his fault. No, it was real. Like, I was there for a lot of it, you know, and it was incredibly painful for him to go through. And I think there's different explanations for, you know, different sort of series, like those early years against the Cardinals. There was some stuff maybe about his pitch sequencing and his stubbornness. It's possible he was tipping, when as he got later into his career, you know, like in 16 against the Cubs, he's dealing with a major back injury. In 17 against the Astros, you know, obviously we kind of know what was going on now at this point. And so I think it is interesting. I think it is a measure of how good he is that his postseason performances, which frankly are not as good as his regular season performances, are considered so important to his legacy, because what was expected of him is, you know, so much higher than other people. You know, he has basically the same postseason FIP as Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander. But I think when you start talking about postseason FIP, you've kind of lost the argument.
Yes.
Right. Like, you know, you're like in the weeds. Right. So I think there's a lot of different explanations for why. I think it's changed with time. I think there's been times he's pitched on short rest in the postseason, especially earlier in his career, in a way that no other pitcher was asked to do. There were times when he was pitching, you know, just he was tremendously fatigued from, you know, the load he was carrying during the season. There was time he was pitching with back injuries, shoulder injuries, all sorts of stuff. But he's never run from, you know, the responsibility for that. You know, he's never made excuses. He's never blamed anyone but himself. I mean, I go back to that image of him after the 2019 postseason, where, you know, he gave up those two sort of, you know, titanic home runs to the Nationals and they lost that series. And he stood there in the middle of the Dodgers clubhouse and said, everything that people say about me in the postseason is true, you know. And rather than, and the next thing he said, I think, was just as important, is he said, I'm not going to sit here and wallow in it. I'm going to try and get better. And that winter, he went to Driveline. He, you know, changed some things about his delivery, regained some velocity, and they went out, you know, the next season. And he had an excellent postseason and they won the World Series. Now, well, we can obviously, people will talk about the merits of that World Series. but at the end of the day, they played a tournament and the Dodgers won at the end, and he was really good in the World Series. And so he's someone who has never shied away from the responsibility of being as good as he is requires. And he's never just sort of accepted the failure as something, you know, that he's going to live with and not try and get better from.
Yeah, and look, people can say that about the World Series in general with that relaunch year, but Clayton Kershaw's performance is still Clayton Kershaw's performance. Like, he threw two gems in the actual World Series, had a really good opening round series as well, went 8 shutout against the Brewers that year to kind of get them where they needed to go in that expanded, I think that was the expanded format series.
It was, yeah. It was like a 16-team playoff, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we count that here right now because it's funny to say that. Like, it's more entertaining to be like, the Jays have been swept three times in a row when they made it versus two times in a row. Like, we wouldn't count that if the Jays had been good the last couple years, but they haven't been. So let's use that as a pivot. Again, the book is called The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw and the Burden of Greatness. You can read a sample chapter up at The Athletic right now. Yeah. Every fifth day, the mentality that drove Clayton Kershaw to greatness, an excerpt from that book. And everyone can check it out on your Twitter. We'll tweet the link out as well. Can't wait to read it. So you are a national writer at The Athletic as well, and you did have that quote to Ken Rosenthal that he brings up all the time, that the Blue Jays were paper. That the Blue Jays were paper tigers last year. Yes. And you roll your eyes a little bit, but the reason he brings it up so much is that you were proven correct. The Toronto Blue Jays underperformed last year. They've underperformed this year so far. What do you make of where the Blue Jays are right now?
I mean, I think it's one of those things that must be very excruciating for Blue Jays fans, and that the answer is right there. It's that their best players need to play better, right? Like, you know, especially at least on the offensive side, right? Like, they need Vladimir Guerrero to be the player, even if he's not a 1,000 OPS player like he was in 2021, they need him to be a lot closer to, you know, the 2022 version, where I think it was like he was like a 135 OPS plus or something like that. You know, they need, you know, Bo Bichette to, you know, be the player he had been in the past. And so it's frustrating, I imagine, when, you know, you look at like the offseason, right? Adding Ohtani would have been great. Sure. But other than that, it's like there's a lot of good players on this roster. I thought getting Justin Turner was a great move. He's been, you know, really strong from so far. The rotation, you know, is solid, and, you know, a group that you can believe in. I think they did good work. Maybe it was 2 years ago, you know, with the bullpen. I know they took a lot of heat for the way that trade worked out last year, you know, where Dalton Varsho came back. But I think Varsho is going to be a really good player. So it's kind of like it's the most challenging place for a team, a fan base, even a front office to be in. It's like the answer's right there. It's just, it's, they have to play better. I mean, right? I mean, am I missing something obvious that, you know, from afar?
No, you're not. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., we not celebrated, but like his OPS scraped over the 700 mark on the weekend, and that was a thumbs up. Bo Bichette's gotten moved down in the order. You know, George Springer, the conversation is even more dire because it's a conversation about, you know, is he an everyday regular anymore at this point? So that's a part of it for sure. They also had an underwhelming offseason, and that wasn't just the Shohei Ohtani chase. That was the subsequent moves as well. And I bring that up because, Andy, you were part of this piece at The Athletic, and we're going back a couple weeks here, but you guys polled MLB executives on who the best front offices were in baseball. And there were 40 different executives who voted in this. And it wasn't just, hey, who is the number one? It was, give us a couple. And you guys ranked them on a point system. And 16 different front offices received votes in that exercise across 40 MLB executives. The Blue Jays were one of the teams that did not receive a vote. And look, the list of teams that didn't receive a vote, it was a lot of teams in the kind of rebuilding or the front office has just changed over phase. There weren't a lot of teams that are trying to compete right now and have had a stable front office over the last almost decade now. What do you make of that, that around baseball, there isn't a sense that, you know, the Blue Jays are in that discussion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that piece was interesting. And I think that the way that we ended up doing it was helpful, but for space reasons, we couldn't get too deep into this just because we didn't want to bore readers. But like, there were very clearly in our polling three teams that were kind of a cut above, and it was the Dodgers, the Rays, and the Atlanta Braves. And if you look at sort of what those teams do, it's like the Dodgers are kind of known as the best at this. They just are. They have the money, they have the resources, you know, they do things well on the farm. The Rays are like, you know, the cheaper version of that. They continue to, you know, spin the flywheel and churn out good players. They're struggling this year, though. They might be, you know, in a real bind this year. And the Braves have built this like sort of this roster of cost-controlled younger, you know, players in their prime who like they can just sort of roll out this lineup for the next 3 or 4 years, right? So what the Braves have is something that if the Blue Jays players were playing up to what their capabilities are or, you know, have been believed to be or have shown to be in the past, you could very easily be like, look at this team. They get, you know, this is a group that acquired Vladimir Guerrero and, you know, Dalton Varsho and Kevin Biggio and Bo Bichette and, you know, all these sort of younger players who you would love to build around. It's just their reputation has taken a hit just because of the underperformance, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
I just think so much of it is just based on, like, you know, teams tend to get credit for being lower in the financial tier. So teams like the Brewers, who are consistently at, like, you know, they've been really good in the Central, you know, for several years. Are they a better team over this past 5 or 6 years than the Blue Jays are, or are they a benefit of geography, right? They also get credit because their owner, you know, doesn't spend as much. And while I totally understand, you know, why Blue Jays fans would be frustrated with ownership not spending as much as they could, they do spend more than a lot of other teams. And so they're in this weird, like sort of middle of the Venn diagram where it's like, we're not a small market team. They don't spend like the top market team. So they don't get the credit for, you know, that like the Rays get, but they're not, you know, able to bang it out or choosing to bang it out with the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Mets, you know, for the top tier free agents. So then it's just a matter of, like, do the players you have, are they playing well? And the past couple of years, they have been underperforming.
Yeah, it's tough. You rank, what, 7th in payroll, and you're like 8th or 9th in wins most year, and you're like 6th in market size. It's like, yeah, you're not the best at anything. You're not the worst at anything, but that's a hard thing to contextualize among 30 teams.
And you play in a division. You play in a division with the Yankees, who just, you know, for all the criticism, again, like, I love the fans. If we learn nothing from this thing, I love all fans. You guys are great. So, like, but Yankees fans have been very frustrated with their team over the past however many years. But that team is a, you know, behemoth that continues to roll on and be successful. The Orioles have really built up something impressive. The Rays are, you know, and the Red Sox, like, there are years when the Red Sox stink and they would win the AL Central. You know, it's just the geography is legitimate. Now, it's not an excuse, but it's a way to contextualize, like, why a team that has been pretty good for a decent amount of time doesn't get the sort of love that maybe some of these other smaller market teams do.
Yeah, and hey, it's going to be an interesting couple of months here. I intended to ask you about the Luis Arraez trade and if we can get more teams being active early like this, but we are about out of time here. Andy, where can people find what is the best way for Andy for us to buy the book?
Do they have Amazon in Canada?
Of course.
Okay, great. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Capitalism is alive and well up here, man.
No, wherever you buy books, like, you know, if you want to, do it through one of your local indies or things like that, that's great. You know, bookshop.org. But if you buy things on Amazon, if you go into Barnes & Noble, you know, wherever, it's available everywhere. You know, there's an audiobook too, thankfully, as the listeners, who've suffered through this. I didn't read it, so like a professional did. I would love for people to give it a read because, you know, I worked hard on it and I'm proud of it. And thank you.
And if the sample chapters up at The Athletic are any indication, it is very, very good. Can't wait to dig in. It's called The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw and the Burden of Greatness. Andy McCullough of The Athletic, author of that book. Thanks so much for taking the time out, man, and congrats once again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was fun.
Andy McCullough of The Athletic. Again, it's The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw and the Burden of Greatness. Came out today. Find it wherever you get your books. Really excited for that one. Really excited for the Jays to be back in action. An off day is nice sometimes. An off day when you just had an off day and the team is playing poorly and there's another off day in like 36 hours. Less so. Less so for sports radio. Less so when you just want some baseball. We'll get some baseball tonight. It'll be Jose Berríos against Christopher Sanchez as the Jays take on the first place Philadelphia Phillies. That is not first place in the NL East, in the NL, anything like that. It is the best team in baseball right now by record. They got another W yesterday. Nick Castellanos may be showing signs of life. We'll talk about that one a little bit more tomorrow. Interested to see how Jose Berríos operates tonight. He has changed his pitch mix up a little bit this year. You've heard the broadcast talk about how he's introduced a cutter. He's only used that against lefties so far, similar to his changeup. So against the lefties, he's like a 5-pitch pitcher that'll mix a lot of stuff in. Against righties so far this year, though, he has thrown his sinker and his slurve or curve, whatever you want to classify that as, 83% of the time. That's up even from last year where he leaned on those two pitches more often against righties, but that is up significantly from last year. He is getting good results on basically everything but the cutter. There's been some good fortune on his sinker, but the fact that generates so many ground balls protects him a little bit. Speaking of ground balls, I'll talk about this on Blue Jay Central a little bit later, but Christopher Sanchez will keep that ball in the ballpark. He's got a 3.68 ERA over six starts. It's not like he's dominating the whole league. He had a 3.44 coming up last year. That's really nice as well. He will walk a guy. He doesn't strike a ton of guys out. It's not a low strikeout rate, but 22%, that's pretty pedestrian in this current environment. But 62.2% ground ball rate. I mentioned it earlier. Max Fried, the only guy with a higher ground ball rate. That is higher than the guys we know as like the big three of ground ball generation in this era right now. Logan Webb, Marcus Stroman, Framber Valdez. So watch out for that heavy sinker. Watch out for the changeup that generates a lot of ground balls. Again, I'll talk about that on Jays Central later. It's Dan, Joe, and Hazel on the call. Jamie and Shy from Blue Jays Central. Ben and Chris on the radio side. Thank you to Arden Zwelling, who will have you covered on sportsnet.ca. From this series, thank you to Andy McCullough. Go check out The Last of His Kind, his Clayton Kershaw biography. Thank you to Amit Mann, Lance Kennedy, Jake Schultz, and Jennifer Rolnick. Behind the glass, it's a 6:40 start. We will be back with you at 11 a.m. tomorrow to talk about that one and to tee up Chris Bassitt against Aaron Nola in game 2 of this short 36-hour 2-game set in Philadelphia. Have a great day, everyone.